On October 17, 2006, New Orleans police were called to the scene of a suicide. A man had jumped from the rooftop bar of the Omni Royal Orleans Hotel onto a parking garage five stories below. When police arrived, they searched the man for identification. In one of his pockets, they found a Ziploc bag containing the man's Army dog tags and a folded sheet of notebook paper that said, quote, "for police only." The note read, in part, "This is not accidental. I had to take my own life to pay for the one I took." The note contained an address and a description of what the police would find inside, a nightmarish crime scene that would shake even the most experienced officers, a murder that would become infamous for the city of New Orleans. I'm Marina. With me, I have my best friend, Laura, and this is Grimm. Starting out with all the big, great words on this podcast. Did I render you speechless?
You did. It was such a good intro. And then for those of you listening, I also have to wait through the intro music. And I always want to give all of my commentary immediately after Marina gives the intro. And I have to hold it for however long that is. And it's too long.
Too long. But we did rock out.
We did.
This is another case that was suggested by our gremlin, Kristen.
Thank you, Kristen.
And she did the last suggestion, too. And I swear I'm not picking favorites, guys. We're just working through our extensive list. And it just so happens that these were the two that I pulled out of the hat recently. Yes. So yes. Thank you, Kristen. She suggested this again on our Discord. So if you want to have a group chat with us, just join our Patreon.
It's so fun.
For this episode, I relied on the article, The Gruesome Tale of Zach Bowen and Addie Hall and What It Says About Our Fascination with True Crime.
Well, by that's the truth.
Delaney Bartlett. We do love true crime.
Well, I was actually thinking when I was silently reacting to your intro in the beginning that I always have to bring myself a little bit down to like there's the element of fascination and interest. And then there's the element of like, these are real people. These are real lives. So I'm always trying to balance those two things. And I maybe should go read that book because I don't know why I'm fascinated. It feels wrong.
But it's a morbid curiosity.
So
I know. Right. Yeah. And this one, I'm giving a lot of background because it really is like a tragic story. Mm. So we're going to go on the journey with them.
Okay. I'm ready.
I can't remember if I said it was by Delaney Bartlett, but it was.
You did. I interrupted you in the middle, but you got it in there.
Okay. The Story of Zach and Addie by Ghost City Tours. I watched the episode of The Final Witness called Graveyard Love, and I read the book Shake the Devil Off, The True Story of the Murder That Rocked New Orleans by Ethan Brown.
I think you have to say Norlands.
Nolans.
Yeah.
Nolans.
Right? Somebody will correct us.
Yeah. I'm going to say New Orleans, okay. like the New Englander that I am. So today we're talking about the tragic love story involving Addie Hall and Zach Bowen. If you couldn't tell by my articles, my bibliography, I want to start out as we tend to do by telling you all about our victim here, Addie Hall. Adrian Addie Hall was born on January 15th, 1976, to a father who was a Vietnam veteran and a homemaker mother in Durham, North Carolina. There's little information on her childhood other than to say she had a rough upbringing. She admitted to friends later in life that she was sexually abused as a child so badly that on one occasion, before her 13th birthday, she had to go to the hospital for a UTI.
Oh, gosh.
So, not a good home life.
No.
She was a free spirit, and she didn't graduate high school. She preferred sewing, dancing, and writing poetry, so what did she need a high school degree for?
Me too, girl.
I know. After dropping out, she traveled the country, relying on the kindness of friends for housing. If she ran out of money, she relied on the kindness of strangers for food and gas money.
Wow.
That's ballsy.
And what time frame was this?
What
decade?
Well, she was born in 76, so this is probably like 80s. Early 90s. Late 80s, early 90s.
Okay.
Yeah. She returned to Durham in the late 1990s and began teaching salsa and ballroom dancing at a local school of dance. However, by 2002, she was restless and packed up and moved to Nolens after spending a few weeks there partying during Carnival. She lived in her car that she parked on a quiet street until she found an apartment. True gypsy.
Yeah.
Can you imagine just leaving with whatever fits in your car and figuring it out as you go?
Have you met me? No, I cannot imagine that.
I literally put, I know the answer is no, because you're like me and that would just give you anxiety.
Thinking about it, I was going to say like the similarities of like enjoying sewing and not wanting to go to school. I was with her on that and then she completely lost me.
Yeah, no, I would need to know. And if I was going to sleep in my car, I'd have to like plan out the street like before I even drove to New Orleans.
Yeah. Have you seen the meme that's like, yeah, I'll go with the flow, but quick question. When does the flow start and is there free parking or?
I relate a lot to that. I Google a lot about parking lots before I go places.
I have a friend who will, when she asks me if we want to go to dinner, she will also send us a screenshot of what the parking is and explain it for me.
I love that journey for you.
It's really nice.
That's great.
Gotta know who you are. Strengths, you know?
Yep. In NOLA, Addie bartended, waitressed, and worked as a maid to earn money and pay her rent. She could never afford a nice apartment, but she'd fix up the apartment she moved into until they felt like home, often leaving them in better shape than she found them after painting and cleaning.
Aww.
Addie was admired by her friends for her creativity, resourcefulness, and dark humor. Her downside, possibly her downfall, was that she could be a nasty drunk.
Oh no.
When she drank heavily, she would turn on even her closest friends. I cannot relate. I'm the happiest drunk. I want to be everyone's friend and eat fish fillets. That's it.
Yeah. Facts. I can attest to that.
I may get murdered in the McDonald's parking lot by a serial killer in a windowless van, but not for being a mean drunk.
No. I think being a mean drunk, in particular as a female, is very dangerous too. Unless you're able to truly defend yourself, it seems like you may get yourself in. Like if you're Eileen Wuornos, go for it. You can be a mean drunk and handle yourself.
You do you.
Yeah, you do you. But otherwise, it seems pretty dangerous.
Yeah, I would agree. The situation with Addie's drunken rage was made worse by the people she interacted with. On one occasion, she led a coke dealer back to her apartment and agreed to let him cut and package his goods in an apartment she shared with someone else for a few bumps.
Oh.
Her roommate was like, what the fuck?
Yep.
And when the dealer was done doing his thing, he handed her a small bag of coke as further payment, and she became enraged, asking her roommate if he was down to ambush the dealer and steal his stash, which he politely declined.
Yeah, no, thank you.
He was like, no I'm good. No. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. Addie unfortunately took an interest in men who matched her drunken persona, aggressive and abusive. She caught one of her boyfriends jerking off to a gay porn one time, and he beat her black and blue and broke her shoulder.
Oh, no.
Addie's relationships with men were complicated. She wanted to be desirable in the life of the party, but if someone gave her too much attention or stared a little too long at the bar, she'd get angry. Mm. Given her history, she had a hard time trusting people, especially men.
Makes sense.
By the end of 2004, Addie's behavior was at its lowest. She even got into a bar fight where she cracked a beer bottle over a patron's head.
Uh-oh.
Despite that drama, she got a job at Hogg's Bar, and that's where she met Zach.
Oh, dear.
Let's talk about Zach's background before we go into their relationship.
It's perfect childhood. Parents were always together and treated him really well, took great care of him, put him in great schools, and that's why they were a match?
100%.
Going a little
if different. You're enjoying Grimm. Zachary Bowen was born to parents Lori and Jack Bowen in Bakersfield, California. Lori and Jack had married when Lori was only 21 in 1972. Within 3 years, she had her first son, Jed, in 1975, and then came Zach on May 15th, 1978. When Zach was only a few months old, the family packed up and left California to live life on the road in a VW bus.
As you do.
Yeah. I'm like, that's my worst nightmare. Thanks.
Literally. Where's the bathroom?
I only go glamping, and yeah. I don't think traveling around in a VW bus counts.
No.
No.
No, I'll do what they do. Have you seen all those van remodels now, though? They're pretty sweet.
They are
not
pretty sweet.
Not just VW bugs, but, or vans, but.
I know.
I could do that.
Down by the river. I'm not meant for that gypsy life. I have way too much stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The family spent some time on the road traveling to Idaho and other parts of California. but ultimately moved back to Bakersfield, California when Jack took a job at an oil company. Jack hated it and wanted to work in theater, having earned a BA in drama while they were out on the road. So he took it out on his family.
Oh, no.
Jack was miserable and quit his job, and Lori was unhappy, but she stuck it out because the kids were small. She urged him to go back to work, and he did. He got a job as a bartender in a strip club.
Oh, dear.
And Lori was like, not quite the wholesome employment I had in mind. Jack eventually went back to the oil business, and the family had a stretch of some good years. They moved around a bit, and it finally fell apart for Lori and Jack when they moved to their new home in Washington on Whidbey Island in Puget Sound. Jack started staying out all night with his friends, leaving Lori alone with the kids, and by 1990, she had enough.
Yeah, fair.
Lori and Jack went through a bitter divorce, and Lori took custody of Zach and Jed and moved to Santa Maria, California, the boys only sporadically visiting their father in Washington.
Sad.
Unsurprisingly, the transition was hard for all of them. Lori was adjusting to being a single mother and divorcee, and the boys were entering their teenage years. Mm-hmm. Zach was described as awkward, shy, and goofy, and he went to Santa Maria High School, and he did well in school, earning A's in most subjects. His senior year, he was nominated as homecoming king.
Really?
Zach was 17 at the time and was obsessed with the thought of winning the title.
Interesting.
You wouldn't think that that fits.
No, and I'm also surprised, though, because it sounds like they moved around a bunch and only in high school-ish had moved to that area. So yeah. That's surprising.
Well, I think he was there for all of his high school. So he had
still like
3 years. Yeah. Cause you know, people from like middle school too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So his mother, Lori, tried to lower his expectations of winning cause she didn't want him to be crushed.
Right.
It's not that she didn't think he was popular enough. It was just that he was into Metallica, the band Tool, and his extracurricular activities involved hulking out on a drum set. Not quite the homecoming king type that we think of, you know, like
the Ken of Barbie and Ken.
Yeah, like the football quarterback. Yeah. You know. Yeah. So, in fact, he wore black pants, a white shirt, and a black cape to give a homecoming nominee speech. And I'm picturing Ben Platt in the magician's outfit at college in Pitch Perfect. And if you tell me you haven't seen that movie, I'm going to cry.
Okay, I've seen Pitch Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I literally wrote, I might cry.
No, I've seen that one.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Lori was right about Zach's chances of winning homecoming. He was not crowned king, and it had a profound impact on his self-esteem and schooling.
Hmm.
His senior year, his grades plummeted, and he began talking about dropping out of high school and moving in with his father in Washington.
Drastic.
Yeah. I mean, it like really affected him.
Yeah.
His mother desperately tried to talk him out of it, but despite the finish line being in sight, his second half of his senior year, he dropped out of high school in early 1996 and moved in with his father.
No.
You had like 3-4 months left.
And I have a feeling that this is the pivot point for what we're going to talk about for the rest of this case. And I am just, it's so frustrating.
I know.
Like, I'm curious though, why the obsession? What about that particular title and all that was so, if he was doing all right, I don't know why there was such an obsession there.
I think part of it, the way that it was framed in that book, Shake the Devil Off, I think it was he had this feeling inside that he was an outsider. Mm-hmm. And I think when he didn't win Homecoming King, that solidified something for him that like he didn't belong or he like something to that, like something profound.
Yeah.
Because it can't just be that he wasn't the most popular. I think it was something much deeper, like a sense of belonging.
Agreed.
After moving around so much.
And that's what I was thinking. But I also was thinking like that is not something that just happens overnight. That is something that probably builds probably your whole life.
Right.
But then, you know, even more so in high school. So I guess I'm not totally surprised that people didn't see it, but I suspect even though he was doing well in school, there was that feeling building throughout his whole time there. So,
and I wonder if that's why his mom kept trying to like, don't get your hopes up.
Exactly.
Because though I can't imagine that she would expect that to be his reaction.
No.
To like drop out of high school.
No. And what exactly can you do?
I don't know. I would have rigged the contest if I knew that was going to be the result.
Literally.
Like, vote for my kid.
Yeah.
When he moved in with his father in an effort to give them both a fresh start, Jack took his son on an extended road trip across the United States that ended in New Orleans.
I was wondering how we got there from California. Okay.
The beginning of his time in New Orleans was rocky. Zach enrolled himself in a local high school, but dropped out after just a few months. Again, just not fitting in. But it wasn't all bad news for Zach. He was no longer a lanky, awkward teen and had grown into his looks. Zach was 6'10" with blondish brown hair, sporting dimples on his tanned, handsome face.
Oh.
And grim fact, he had a size 17 shoe.
Goodness.
I think at that point you just wear the boxes when you were shopping.
I was going to say, you know what they say. Big feet, big hands.
There's a comedian who's like, oh, you know what they say? If he's got big hands, if he's got big feet, if he's got a big nose, he goes, well, he better be packing because that's one doofy looking motherfucker.
I think that's what I was poorly attempting to quote. Yes.
Good job.
So much funnier when you say it.
You're welcome. In the summer of 1996, when he was 18, Zach put his good looks to use and started selling Go Cups at the bars on Bourbon Street.
Hmm. Okay.
Luring women off the street to purchase beer and shots to go through a window. Lena Shupak, a 28-year-old stripper on vacation in New Orleans from Texas, was one of the women lured in by Zach's call. 3 days after meeting, Zach and Lena went on their first date.
Oh.
At the end of her vacation, she returned to Texas, but Zach called and called and begged her to return to New Orleans, which she did. The fall of 1996, the two were inseparable until Lena found out that Zach was only 18.
Yep.
Well, you know, he's 6'10", yeah. So I wouldn't think he's that young either. But in early 1997, Lena found out she was pregnant with Zach's baby. And she broke the news to him in March. Zach was naturally conflicted about being a teen dad, but he decided to commit himself to the role. But Lena wasn't as committed to the idea given Zach's age, and she kept Zach at arm's length and didn't even tell him when she went into labor.
Yikes.
He found out a few weeks later when Lena's friend called him about the birth of his first son, Jackson. And when Zach met Jackson for the first time, his reluctance completely dissolved, and it was love at first sight.
Oh, that makes me sad.
I know. His love of Jackson warmed Lena back up to the idea of them as a couple, and the two were reunited when Jackson was 6 weeks old. Zach committed himself to Lena, Jackson, and got a job at a hotel bartending. However, his job required him to be out late nights, and he was surrounded by booze and drugs. One night, he was arrested for possession of drug paraphernalia because he was with someone who had a makeshift bong, and they thought it was Zach's.
Oh, it's my friend's. It's not mine.
It genuinely was really his friend. Yeah. And in case you were wondering, it was made out of a Coke can.
Not an apple.
Not a pickle or an apple.
2 liter bottle.
Or 2 liter
whatever
bottle.
Whatever the hell we think.
Yep. Whatever the kids are smoking out of these days. The charges were ultimately dropped, but Zach was so embarrassed. Hmm. He called his brother Jed for advice, even though they hadn't been that close, and Jed had enlisted in the army in 1994, and he told Zach that he should join. Zach told him he'd think about it. Not long after, Zach proposed to Lena.
Oh.
This is so romantic.
Oh.
He said, you want health insurance? If we get married, you can have health insurance. Have you heard a more romantic American proposal in your life?
That's so practical.
No. Lena said yes.
Yeah, fair.
And days before the wedding, she found out she was pregnant with their second child.
Good thing you have health insurance.
The two were married on October 10th, 1998, and Zach's daughter Lily was born in June 1999. With the pressure on to provide for his family, Zach earned his high school degree in March 2000, and 2 months later, he enlisted in the Army for an 8-year term.
Whoa.
Zach completed basic training and was shipped off to Germany. On January 10th, 2001, his company was deployed to Kosovo for a peacekeeping mission. In Kosovo, they started out just patrolling the streets, but their platoon was later assigned the task of uncovering mass graves of Albanians and confronting violent Serbians.
Yikes.
One day, Zach gave a little Albanian girl a piece of candy and then found out later the little girl had been executed by Serbs for interacting with an American.
Oh.
And that messed him up.
Fair. That's fair.
Zach returned to Germany 5 months later and would be joined by Lena, Lily, and Jackson. Mm. But then came 9/11.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking about the timeline of all this.
And by mid-January 2003, Zach was shipped out to Kuwait in preparation to fight in the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. Zach's platoon crossed into Iraq the day after the war started. While in Baghdad, Zach's platoon was constantly under attack with guns and bombs. Fellow soldiers lost their limbs and their lives in Zach's presence. Ugh. Zach survived and was able to return to Germany in November 2003. But he came back a different person.
I bet.
An empty person. And Zach's physical health took a toll. He was developing PTSD and had frequent severe headaches. He was short of breath, coughing, wheezing, had a rash on his back, and body aches. Jeez. Zach was mad what the war had done to him, so he started failing his physical fitness tests. He failed several and was threatened with discharge. By fall 2004, Zach was discharged from the Army. And even though his company commander recommended that he be honorably discharged, for unknown reasons, he was given a general under honorable circumstances discharge, which could disqualify him from certain benefits and would make it harder for him to find a civilian job when he got home.
That's messed up.
The general discharge, so they sounded the same to me, but mm-hmm. the breakdown was the general discharge is given if the negative aspects of the service member's conduct outweigh the positive. And that discharge was unfair for Zach, considering he served in Kosovo and Iraq as a military policeman and earned several medals, including the NATO medal and the Presidential Unit Citation, which is awarded to military units that have performed a heroic act in the face of an armed enemy.
What? Yeah, like what did he do that's not good other than he had PTSD and was completely messed up and having a hard time with that?
Right.
If that's his only fault, like, come on.
His only issue were those failed physical tests.
That's frustrating.
So they inexplicably kicked him to the curb. And I can't imagine what that does to you psychologically, too.
Yeah. Ugh.
Zach told Lena they were out. But Zach wouldn't explain why to Lena. So she got really pissed and she left. She left Zach and the boys who were in school at the time in Germany. And she returned to New Orleans.
What?
They eventually followed her home, but when they met her at the airport, she told Zach that she had found someone new.
Oh, come on.
Mm-hmm. The family ended up still living together because Zach was too bored to live on his own and Lena was working, so he was caring for the kids while he was still looking for a job. So that must have been pretty awkward, but...
Definitely.
He found a job bartending at a local dive called Hogs Bar. It was there that he met Addie in the late spring of 2005.
Oh, and he's in a great mental state for a new relationship.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Addie would relieve Zach as bartender, and Zach was instantly drawn to Addie. He would stay late past his shift to talk to her and get to know her better. It was so bad that his manager banned him from the bar when he wasn't working.
Jeez.
Addie was resistant at first, given her trust issues with men, but Zach's persistence wore her down. By July, Addie and Zach had begun seeing each other. And then everything changed in August 2005 when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans.
Oh, if only I thought about where we are in the world, despite my asking about dates and all that. Oh my God, I didn't even think of that.
I know, this story is, there's a lot. The hurricane was upgraded to a Category 5 on August 28th, 2005, and residents were mandated to evacuate. Addie stocked up her apartment with booze and ice from Hogs Bar, ready to ride out the storm.
Oh, no, no. No, no.
Zach was planning to evacuate the French Quarter and stay with Lena and the kids. He stopped by Addie's place to say goodbye, but when he saw her, he just couldn't leave. Lena was pissed, but Zach was staying come hell or high water.
Literally.
I put no pun intended, but also literally. Hurricane Katrina made landfall on August 29th and was gone by the 30th, but the damage was done. Mm-hmm. Catastrophic damage. During the storm, 53 levees broke, flooding and destroying 200,000 houses, 81,000 businesses, 175 schools, and 6 major hospitals. The first couple of weeks after the storm were dangerous in various areas of New Orleans with no police presence and people breaking into stores to take what they needed. Mm-hmm. The police were missing for about 6 days post-Katrina, and when they were seen, it was to ask if anyone had weapons because they were being overrun.
Yikes.
Just a few blocks away from where Zach and Addie were, bodies were floating in the street.
Ugh.
Fingers and arms could be seen sticking out of attic windows, and people were sleeping in their own urine and feces in the Superdome.
Oh, I remember hearing about all that, but it's... tragic.
It is tragic.
To say the absolute least.
I can't imagine. Like, one of the interviews on one of the episodes was like, there was a body floating in Walgreens.
Insane.
Like, I just can't.
No.
I can't even fathom.
No.
But Zach and Addie were living in a completely different world. The French Quarter was on higher ground, so it was relatively unscathed.
Oh.
Zach and Addie had rode out the storm together, only leaving the apartment once the winds died and the sun came out. Of the few who rode out the storm, by choice or necessity, many evacuated after the storm to escape the lack of food, water, and power.
Mm-hmm.
If they weren't leaving before, they weren't leaving now. With their area being dry, Zach and Addie stayed and formed a sense of community with those who had also refused to leave both pre and post Katrina. Zach and Addie cleared their street of garbage and debris using tree limbs for campfires. At night, they would throw back cocktails. And there's actually several photos of Zach and Addie together after Hurricane Katrina that were taken by reporters who were drawn to their story of love and community among the ruins.
Of course.
And they were even featured in the New York Times.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. I'll include those pictures on our Insta.
I can't wait to see them. And what were they eating?
They had canned foods.
Okay.
Canned beans and soups.
All right. Yeah. That's good.
And the article said that Addie ensured there was a steady flow of officers regularly patrolling their house because she would flash the cop cars as they patrolled the area. I'm like, I like that. Honestly, that's resourceful.
Brilliant. Yeah.
I love that. Zach and Addie, as experienced bartenders, would mix drinks for passersby. They would feed stray cats. They sang songs and thrived in a community with no need for money or responsibility.
Wow.
They'd put out a table and serve beans and soup cooked over a campfire with their neighbors and friends. Zach doted on Addie in a way that she had never experienced before. And Zach called his mother and told her that he had met the love of his life. It was a fairy tale.
I'm speechless, actually. I don't know where we're going. I know it's bad, and I just am having a hard time wrapping my head around that.
It ends in blood and feathers.
Yes.
All good things must come to an end. Some of the post-Katrina circumstances had a traumatic effect on the couple. On one supply gathering mission, Addie went into a local store on her own while Zach waited outside. A man in the store grabbed Addie in one of the aisles and tried to rape her.
Come on.
Addie was able to get away, but was shaken, especially given her history.
Mm-hmm.
To add insult to injury, after weeks of eating canned foods, their survivalist roommate, Jack, had scored hamburger meat. As soon as he put it on the grill, hundreds of fat green flies descended onto the meat.
Are you kidding me?
I want to say I remember hearing about the flies from all the water and the like, just like the bodies and the decay it was that like the hope and then the devastation with the meat was actually too much for Addie and she broke down.
I can't blame her at all.
And Zach started to go downhill as well. Zach's PTSD had been triggered by the military presence in New Orleans after Katrina. He began having intrusive memories from Iraq and would wake up screaming in the middle of the night.
That's heartbreaking.
As society got back up and running, Zach and Addie struggled to go back to the way things were. On September 19th, the mayor of New Orleans announced that residents who left before Katrina could return home. Zach and Addie judged those that returned and sneered at them as though they were disloyal citizens for following orders. By the end of October, Zach and Addie were forced out of their love bubble and back into their ordinary life.
Mm.
They both went back to bartending, and Zach had to take on a second job as well to pay for child support, as Lena was demanding that Zach resume his parental responsibilities.
I mean, that's also fair.
Yeah. Very fair, yeah. Yes. Addie had gotten a job at the Spotted Cat, a jazz bar, and Zach was working as a grocery delivery man, where the tips were pretty good during busy tourist seasons. While Zach had enjoyed his time thanks to Hurricane Katrina, Lena had been forced to care for Jackson and Lily on her own,
mm-hmm.
having to stay at a shelter before being evacuated to a town in Texas 6 hours away, where she waitressed at an Applebee's to support herself and the kids.
Yikes. Yeah.
Not only had Zach shirked his financial responsibilities while he was living it up with Addie, he never even returned any of her phone calls.
Come on. And therefore his kids' phone calls.
Right.
Yeah.
When Lena returned to New Orleans, she went to Zach's apartment with a baseball bat, which is pretty dramatic, but I don't blame her at that point.
Yep. I think you would also have a baseball bat if left alone with your children.
Yes. I'd be like, you did what during Hurricane Katrina?
You slept?
Zach wasn't home, but it was Addie was, and she didn't answer the door, which that's how you stay alive. Yes. Zach met up with Lena away from the apartment, and Zach was hostile towards her. He said Addie didn't want to ever see her again, and Lena was like, if you think the kids are going to be staying with you and Addie, I have to meet her.
Mm-hmm.
Zach was nervous about breaking that news to Addie, that the kids would stay with them on a biweekly basis and that she had to meet Lena in order for them to do so. But Addie, to his surprise, was excited.
Hmm.
And she even bought clothes for Jackson and Lily, ready to fulfill her role as a type of stepmom.
Okay.
But when the time came, she did not rise to the occasion. During the first drop-off, she refused to meet Lena and sulked in the car. During their stay, she refused to interact with the kids and would leave to frequent bars instead, coming home drunk and shutting herself in the bedroom with Zach. Zach tried to include Addie in his life and his kids' lives, but she wasn't interested in all that. She just wanted Zach back in their bubble. And tensions rose.
I can imagine. I mean, even thinking about, like, I'm not sure how many weeks it was that they were living in their bubble after the flood, after the hurricane, I mean, but I cannot imagine living in that and then trying to go back to the real world at all. And then especially if you were someone that kind of enjoyed the community and different way of living. And then Now to add all of this where she has to share him and its responsibilities and all that. I'm not saying her behavior is excused, but I can see why she reacted like that.
Right. They really had a hard time. And I mean, mm-hmm. they both had hard lives. Mm-hmm. And then this thing that had such devastating mm-hmm. consequences for some people turned out to be the brightest spot in their lives thus far.
Yeah.
Makes sense that she would do well with that, like having that gypsy lifestyle. But yeah. By the end of November, Addie was so hostile towards Zach and the kids that she forced him to rent a hotel room when they were there. Addie, who was living with bipolar disorder, was off her lithium and surrounded by booze and drugs at her job. She began trying to self-medicate. Both her and Zach were trying to chase the high of their former life, mm-hmm. and they both started drinking more heavily and doing cocaine. Addie and Zach would go on marathon drinking and drug sprees and were constantly fighting, with friends describing Addie as a mean drunk in one of her spells. One night, the two had such a bad fight, neither remembered when they woke up, but they knew it had to have gotten physical since Addie had bruises.
Yikes.
Zach couldn't stand Addie's verbal abuse any longer and said he needed a break, leaving to go see his father in Oregon. He told his family he was done with New Orleans, but Lena found out he had left and was like, "No, get your ass back here. I'm not going to lie to your kids. You have a family here." And Addie missed Zach, and she was miserable without him.
Mm-hmm.
A mutual friend knew how strong their love was for each other, so he bought Zach a ticket back to New Orleans.
Oh, no.
Zach and Addie were reunited, and they didn't leave the apartment for 3 days. But both fell into their old bad habits, and Addie's mean streak got worse. The summer of 2006, Zach and Addie fought and broke up on a nearly daily basis.
Good
God. Zach would move all of his stuff out using his grocery delivery bike until Addie let him come home. He used his work bike so often for his stuff that his coworkers called it his moving truck.
Oh.
In mid-August, Addie's temper got her arrested. She had been fighting with Zach before she stalked off with a handgun. She got into a verbal altercation with a man on the street and pulled the gun on him. The man called the cops, and Addie ran back to her apartment and changed into a nightgown to try to fool the cops.
Yeah. Which I'm just like, you know, sure.
I was home all night sleeping.
I know the Shark Week doesn't start till 4. No, cops doesn't start till 4.
Yep. In her apartment, police found the gun and some marijuana, so she was charged with mm-hmm. aggravated assault with a firearm, first offense possession of marijuana, and possession of drug paraphernalia. Zach refused to bail her out, mm-hmm. despite mm-hmm. having the funds to do so, but Addie's friends pooled their money to pay her bail, and she got back with Zach once released.
Oh my God.
A little more than a month after Addie's arrest, Zach and Addie were fighting at 5 a.m. Addie pushed Zach out the door, and Zach started loudly banging on the door and yelling for her to let him in. Cops showed up and saw Zach toss a tiny bag of weed as they approached that he had in his pocket. He was charged with possession, and Addie bailed him out after 2 days for $500.
Wow.
Now, my question to the universe is, what are you fighting about at 5 a.m? Because I had neighbors once that would fight at 5 a.m. I mean, like, all out brawl screaming. And I'm like, brah, you haven't even had your coffee yet.
Have they gone to bed?
Okay, or, if you're coming at the clock from the other direction, yeah, I guess there's more to fight about because now you're sleep deprived.
I was going to say, I would fight about everything if I hadn't gone to bed yet.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. But they also probably get up at like 2 p.m.
Right.
So it's a little bit different.
True.
But yeah, I'm like, I need...
It's the only thing I can think of, though.
I need so much coffee to fight full volume. Yeah. In fact, I never fight full volume. I don't know what it would take to fight full volume, but...
I would hear you from my side of town if you fought full volume.
You'd be like, what's that noise? Oh, Marina's in a fight.
Marina's caffeinated and mad.
I'm going to put that on a shirt. Caffeinated and mad. I like that. To make matters worse, Zach and Addie were getting their Coke for free from their mutual friend, Squirrel.
Squirrel!
Zach and Addie had taken care of Squirrel when he was down and out, and they'd loaned him some money when he couldn't pay his bill for rent. In exchange, he said that they could use from his stash when they needed it. And use they did.
Mm-hmm.
As their fights intensified, so did their appetite for drugs, and they were using about $400 worth of Coke a week.
Yeah, I'm going to say that they were coming at the clock from the other hour, from the other side.
Oh, yeah, with all the Coke. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. For like 48 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that was like the third time they had seen 5 a.m.
Yes, that's exactly it.
It's more than 48 hours, but math is not my strong suit.
72. I got you.
Squirrel had been loaned.
I forgot that Squirrel. Was his name and thought that's what you were saying.
Squirrel. It's perfect for a discussion about Coke. Squirrel.
It really is.
Squirrel had been loaned $900 and they were using $400 of Coke a week. And he was like, this math is not mapping. So he was like, I need to cut this off.
Yeah.
When Squirrel tried to end his debt, he did it by offering them a final delivery of about $600 worth of Coke. He's like, hey, why don't you just like take this and we'll call it even.
Yeah.
Addie freaked out and Squirrel was like, nope, never mind. I was just kidding. I was just totally just kidding. And Zach was like, I'm really sorry for her. Sorry.
Uh-huh.
Unbeknownst to Addie, her insane behavior that she was doing was pushing Zach into the arms of a man that he had met at a gay bar.
I have not at any one point in this story not known what direction it's going.
It's going in every direction.
It is.
All at once.
Yes.
Every direction. There's a lot of spiraling going around. I'm spiraling.
I was going to say, we need to just acknowledge Marina got an espresso machine and has had how many?
Five.
Okay.
Today.
So if you think you accidentally hit 1.25 speed on your podcast, you did not. She is just very caffeinated and luckily not mad.
I think I stopped drinking it today at 11, and I'm hoping that was late enough. I don't know. I can still feel and hear the blood flowing through my body, so I don't think it was late enough. So Zach got himself a boyfriend. He was dating a local real estate agent, and although he tried to keep the relationship a secret, news got back to Addie. Addie taunted Zach, pissed at his infidelity. Oh. Mm. She stole his cell phone, called all the women in his contact list, and told them he had AIDS, then deleted all of the numbers. I mean, like, bad.
Diabolical.
Like, this relationship was bad, toxic, bad, bad. Addie told a friend in mid-September that she, quote, had things on Zach that proved he was dangerous. She said, everyone loves him, but he's fucking crazy. Everyone thinks he's the nice, clean-cut guy. He's not. He's fucked up from being in the war. Mm. He mentioned something about witnessing a child being murdered. It's really fucked him up, and I can't deal with it. But Addie was having financial trouble, and she was living in an apartment with unacceptable conditions. She knew she was close to being evicted due to a breakdown in the relationship between her and her landlord, and she couldn't afford the deposit on a new rental on her own.
Mm-hmm.
So she got back with Zach, basically just for the money at this point. And he agreed to front her the money and would move back in with her once they found a place. The couple decided they'd try to get a fresh start with this apartment. They walked down Rampart Street holding hands, and they found an apartment above the famed Voodoo Temple with a for rent sign. It was available immediately, and the couple made an offer right away. Because it was rare in post-Katrina days for renters to have a month's worth of rent and a one-month deposit up front, the landlord, Leo Watermeyer, handed them the keys before drawing up a lease.
Oh, jeez.
On October 4th, 2006, unbeknownst to Zach, Addie went over Zach's head and signed a six-month lease in her name only, which meant that she could kick him out. She was still seething that he had cheated on her with a man, and Zach was devastated because he had just paid for the apartment, and he had told Lena that he could take the kids the next week in the new apartment.
Zach and Addie began fighting, and that fighting carried on for hours and hours. The lease was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Also, what was her plan, though? Like, she had the first month's rent, but what was her plan to pay for beyond that?
I think she could afford the rent, but she couldn't afford, like, the upfront deposits.
Okay.
Because it was, like, basically 2 months' rent that was due up front, and she couldn't afford that.
Fair.
Around midnight, the fighting turned physical. Zach was angry, inconsolable, and drunk. And at 1 a.m. on October 5th, 2006, Zach strangled Addie to death in their bed.
Before I could even acknowledge that you were giving an exact date and I was going to make a funny little comment that that's not good, you sure confirmed that.
It wasn't good.
It was not good.
Zach showed up at...
Sorry, I'm still reacting to that.
Are you verklempt?
Yes. Favorite word.
Zach showed up at his job the next morning looking like a mess.
I bet.
He told a close friend that Addie had ripped him off for a bunch of money, moved out of their apartment, and returned to her home in North Carolina. Almost 2 weeks after Addie's death, on October 17th, 2006, Zach went to see his friend Squirrel. Zach had been on a two-week bender, buying friends shots of Jameson, lap dances at the local Hustler Club, and $20 bags of cocaine.
Yikes.
Really living it up.
Yeah.
Zach woke Squirrel up and said, "Let's go. We're going out." Squirrel was still nursing a hangover from the night before and wasn't interested in a repeat at the moment. Zach grabbed a bag of coke from him, as he had so many times in the past, and left to head to the Omni Royal Orleans Hotel on St. Louis Street. Zach took the elevator to the observation deck next to La Riviera's rooftop pool bar. He opened a tab and started taking shots of Jameson, smoking cigarettes by the pool. When a local Latin band started playing at 5, Zach stood up from his spot by the pool and started pacing nervously. He continued to drink, and just before 8:30, Zach put his drink down and walked up to the roof railing, and then back again.
Ugh.
He proceeded from the edge of the pool to the edge of the roof, pacing back and forth 2 more times before throwing himself over the railing at 8:30 sharp.
Ooh.
Zach landed on an adjacent parking garage roof 5 stories down. Very soon after, a local hotel guest saw Zach's body on the roof and called the front desk, who called 911. The New Orleans PD received a call that there had been a suicide. Police arrived at the scene a little after 8:30. Zach had blood pouring from his mouth and head, and they said his hips were unnaturally twisted.
Uh-huh.
But other than that, the scene wasn't too gory. Based upon his injuries, they had concluded that he had died on impact.
I was thinking to myself, is it possible for someone to survive that onto presumably concrete? I would think not, but I'm glad that he didn't survive that.
5 stories, if you landed feet first, I think you might survive for a minute.
That's what I was worried about. I think you'd have all sorts of internal broken and bleeding things, but...
Yeah, because I think your feet would go through your stomach.
Yeah, I would think so. Because that 5 stories is like, what, 50 feet more than that?
Right? I think it's more than that.
Yeah. Far. It's far.
Distances aren't my strong suit either. I'm not actually sure what my strong suit is, but it's not math or distances.
And this is where we remind you that Marina's legal corner is not legal advice ever.
Yes. And this is also where we remind you that we get a moment of levity among like the deepest, darkest pieces of story. Because we just have to.
Yeah.
It's too much. It's too much.
Mm.
Police searched Zach's body for identification and they found something else they weren't expecting. There was a Ziploc bag in his pocket with Zach's army dog tags containing his full name and a folded sheet of notebook paper that said "for police only" on the outside of it. It said, "This is not accidental. I had to take my own life to pay for the one I took. If you send a patrol to 826 North Rampart, you will find the dismembered corpse of my girlfriend Addie in the oven, on the stove, and in the fridge, along with full documentation on the both of us and a full signed confession from myself. The keys in my right front pocket are for the gates. Call Leo Watermeyer to let you in." It was signed Zach Bowen.
Wow.
Yes.
And I had been wondering this whole time what he had done with Addie's body, because you didn't mention it, and now I know.
I'm going to tell you.
Oh.
The officers were confused and felt like this was either a practical joke or that they were in some kind of horror movie.
Yeah, or that they were being set up for something.
Right.
Or, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The cops rushed to the home of Leo Watermeyer at 812 Rampart Street, and they knocked on the door. Leo answered and was shocked to hear that they wanted to look inside for a dismembered corpse.
Fair.
The cops checked Leo's oven, stove, and refrigerator, but there was nothing to find.
When the cops realized they were in the wrong apartment, Leo walked them one block down the street to Zach and Addie's apartment.
Oh, they searched Leo's apartment.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, now I thought he was just perplexed as to why they wanted to see if there was a dismembered corpse in Zach and Addie's apartment, which
probably
would be also
too
concerning, yes, but far more concerning in the place that you were just sitting.
I think I'd be confused if someone was looking for a dismembered corpse anywhere, even if I yes didn't own the location yes they wanted to search.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Disturbing.
When police entered Zach and Addie's apartment, the air was cold, like they were in a meat locker. The window unit air conditioner was set to 60 degrees. The place was a mess. There were beer cans stuffed with cigarette butts all over the floor, all over the table, and unopened moving boxes were by the door. Spray painted on the wall were the following messages. Please call my wife. I love her. I'm a total failure. And on the ceiling above Zach and Addie's bed was a message. Please help me stop the pain.
Oh, that's so, so tragic and heartbreaking.
That's why I felt it was so important to give both of their backstories.
Yeah.
Like
yeah
they were just a powder keg. And this yeah is just tragic for both of them.
Wow.
Just for both of them. There was one more message on the walls. It said, look in the oven. In the kitchen, there was a large silver arrow spray painted pointing toward the oven. One police officer opened the oven door and found Addie's charred legs oof in a tinfoil baking pan.
Oof.
On the front burner of the oven was a large cooking pot containing Addie's head.
Oof.
On the back burner was another pot containing her hands and feet. And last but not least, inside of the refrigerator was Addie's legless, armless, headless torso inside of a black garbage bag.
I was unprepared for the... I know you said gruesome, but I was unprepared. This is like... Do you remember Colby did a... I think it was a bonus episode, like way early on. Was it Hello Kitty? Was it that one?
Yes. Yes, it was.
It reminds me of that. Where
this is also giving me Catherine Knight vibes with the cooking.
Yes.
Cooking the butt cheeks in the oven.
Yeah, that one. That was a lot funnier though.
That was to serve to his kids, yeah, which that's not really funny.
But but the conversation about the butt cheek and the butt hair was a lot funnier.
And Colby's delicious thighs.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, no, it is.
Oh my God.
It's grim.
And it is. And even to think about, these are the thoughts that go through my head, is like, why did you have it in the oven? You couldn't have taken it. Like, you had to go through the trouble of spray painting, look in the oven, and then an arrow versus taking it out of the oven. Just, I know that's a very, very minor thing in the disturbing things that we're talking about, but just goes to show I don't think, to say the least, he was not well.
I don't think logic applied
right
here.
Exactly.
Like, what would be, he left detailed instructions at least.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So crazy.
He left a long 8-page suicide note in Addie's journal that she wrote in every day. I wish I could have found a full copy of it, but I found quoted bits and pieces, and there were a lot of parts that were summarized, so I put as much of it together as I could. The letter explained that him and Addie got into the big fight on the night of October 4th that turned physical around midnight. An hour later, Zach said he strangled Addie to death in their bed. He wrote, quote, she had stolen this apartment, ask Leo Watermeyer, he'll explain that one, tried to kick me out, then would not shut the fuck up, so I very calmly strangled her. It was very quick. Zach was then overcome with rage, sadness, lust, and confusion, so he engaged in necrophilia with her corpse.
Oh, no, 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 no. No.
He wrote, quote, after sexually defiling the body a few times, I was posed with the question of how to dispose of the corpse, end quote. But Zach didn't clean up the crime scene that night and instead passed out in bed next to Addie's dead body in a drunken stupor. He woke up around 6 a.m. the next day and went to work at the small grocery store, working until 9 p.m. that night. He returned home and he still had the task of disposing of her body, so he figured that he should dismember her and cook her body to ease the flesh off the bone, which I don't understand the logic behind that either. Like, what would that do?
Well, you can do
for
the bones.
You. Right.
Maybe he thought bones were easier to get rid of or less identifiable. Which is not true, but I'm just...
Yeah. And again, I'm trying to apply logic to an illogical situation.
Oh.
He moved her to the bathtub where he dismembered her using a hacksaw and a knife. The bathroom light remained on even after he became too exhausted to continue and he went to bed. He said, quote, I got drunker and some hours later turned off the stove, filled the tub with water and passed out. I was to be off all weekend, so I had plenty of time to work, but due to laziness, spent most of that time coked up in various bars with different girls.
Oh, imagine being, I mean, you would never know, but.
No.
Ugh.
Yeah.
You want to come back to my place?
Can you imagine seeing the news and you're like, I banged that dude.
But what if he asked them back?
I don't think that he did that.
Well.
I think maybe that would have made the headlines.
Yeah, true. True.
During the day, Zach did things like speak with his wife and get his kids candy from his job. He'd then return home and get to work.
Oh.
Again, he said, quote, Sunday night, I sawed off the rest of the legs and arms and put them in roasting pans, stuck them in the oven, and passed out. I came to 7 hours later with an awful smell emanating from the kitchen.
I was thinking it must have smelled horrendous.
Horrendous. I turned off the oven and went to work Monday. This would be the last day I'd work. End quote. Afterwards, he meticulously cleaned the bathroom and spray painted his wife Lena's number on the wall above the bathtub.
Oh my God.
He expressed his regret saying, quote, I scared myself not only by the action of calmly strangling the woman I've loved for 1.5 years, but by my entire lack of remorse. I've known forever how horrible a person I am. Ask anyone. So I decided to quit my job and spend the $1,500 in cash I had being happy and kill myself. Oof. And so he did.
My God.
His suicide note contained memories of his final days partying with his friends with, quote, good food, good drugs, good strippers, having, quote, a fantastic time living out my days. He also quoted Metallica's Saint Anger, fuck it all, and fucking no regrets. And that song has been stuck in my head every time I read my notes. Fuck it all and fucking no regrets. It's a good song if you don't know it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The note revealed what many had already known. That Zach was haunted by his past.
Mm-hmm.
He detailed his life's failures. Friends, jobs, military, marriage, love. Mm. He had 28 cigarette burns on his body to mark his failures for each year of his existence.
Oh my God. And then that just drove home that he's only 28.
Mm-hmm.
Or was only 28.
The end of the note appeared to be directed towards police officers. He wrote, quote, it's just about time now. The only numbers left are friends and family members. So go to work. Based upon the crime scene, there were rumors that Zach had engaged in cannibalism after cooking Addie's remains. Mm. That was proven to be false during Zach's mm-hmm. autopsy. There were no human remains found in his system, but the medical examiner did find the cigarette burns that Zach had detailed in his suicide mm-hmm. note.
Mm.
Lena was left to care for Zach's children on her own. And in an effort to help Jackson and Lily deal with their father's death, she took them to a psychiatrist
mm-hmm.
who recommended that they be told all of the details about the murder-suicide. Jackson was 8 and Lily was 6. And I'm not a professional, but what the fuck?
I saw your face when you said they went to a psychiatrist. I was like, no, that's great. Not great. Very bad.
Very
I was
bad.
Already thinking, like, before you said any of that, these poor kids who, like, not only did their dad die, kill himself, but now it, all these details that they would, I thought, eventually find.
Yeah. And Lena thought the same thing, but she was like, well, they're a professional. They must know better. So she told them everything that Zach did, including dismembering Addie's body.
How you don't even understand. You barely know what, you don't even know what death is at that age. You don't understand how, what that would do.
I remember taking a death and dying class, and there in the book, they went through the different stages of understanding mm-hmm. of death in children. And I remember at like 4 or 5 years old, like they understand that somebody died mm-hmm. means that they're like no longer living, but then they think that they just come back.
Right.
And that's why when you hear like toddlers like shooting their friends and they're like, oh, okay, like when's Billy coming
right.
back? Like they just don't understand.
Right. No, they're not. And then I'm just, yet again, I'm speechless from this.
I'm sure it will come as no surprise to you that the kids did not take the information well.
No.
Jackson became quiet and reflective while Lily made crayon drawings of Zach leaping off of the roof of the Omni Royal, and she was panic-stricken with a constantly upset stomach. When Lena took Lily to see a gastroenterologist, the doctor pulled Lena aside and asked, did he eat her?
Oh my God.
Can you fucking imagine? I would be like, I actually can't think of a question that's more none of your business.
You can't do a case like this because it renders me speechless. And as we've discussed, this is unacceptable for a podcast.
That's why when I listen to yours, I go, yes. Oh, yeah. I give you feedback, verbal feedback.
Oh, I think I'm giving you feedback. I think you know right where I am.
To a certain extent, Lena was relieved that Zach took his own life after what he did to Addie because mm-hmm. she could not imagine what she would face if he was still alive, mm-hmm. if this is what she was facing when he was dead.
Yeah.
Less than a decade after the murder, a woman named Mary Voodoo Queen Milan leased the building on Rampart Street and set up shop as the Bloody Mary Haunted Museum and Tour. For a fee, visitors are let into the Bowen Hall apartment to view the very stove and fridge where Hall's remains were found. Reports are that the apartment was decorated like a bad horror film at one point, complete with fake blood splashes and a bride and groom set of Chucky dolls. Come on.
So when I say I'm fascinated by true crime, it is the psychology. It is
right.
Definitely a layer of the gruesome because it, I don't know, I haven't dug into why, but it's not that.
It's not like that side of things. Film. No. Yeah. One friend of the couple called it, quote, despicable and mm-hmm. atrociously exploitative.
Mm-hmm. That's the word. That's mm-hmm. what I don't like.
Yep. The exploit.
Yep.
Then in 2017, the TLC series Paranormal Lockdown did an episode in the apartment, which was no longer decorated like a low-budget horror film. The investigators reported sensing a cold draft despite the windows being closed and a, quote, presence in the bathroom.
There's not even anything like paranormal about this story at all. I don't understand why they're...
No, just that she was murdered right. in the apartment. I think any time a life is lost, but...
I guess.
That is the incredibly tragic story.
Wow.
Of Zach and Addie. And for me, so... When you hear just the basic details of it. So when I went into this, I had heard of this story before and I knew that they had been in a relationship during mm-hmm. Hurricane Katrina. And then I knew that he died by suicide mm-hmm. and I knew that he had her parts in various places in the mm-hmm. oven. I didn't know about like the PTSD yeah. and the coke and the drinking and the drugs and this like volatile relate. They were just in this like,
yeah.
volatile relationship and neither it was like Groundhog Day mm-hmm. for them and they just like couldn't break out of that cycle and yeah. it's almost like it was inevitable for them.
Absolutely. And again, like whether it was Zach or somebody else, I think Addie would have found herself in a bad scenario like that, just the way that her life was going, especially right. with being off of her medicine and getting into drugs and alcohol to that extent. And then again, like just the complete tragedy, the lack of support of PTSD in veterans is just, I'm not to get on a soapbox on that, but it's just like, it's so heartbreaking to me because they're doing something that I have not signed up for, cannot do, could not do.
I know.
And then it's just does that to them. And then they come home and it's just, I mean, I don't know what resources were made available, but it,
well, don't forget, too, he got the general discharge, oh, so he right. didn't even get yeah. the benefits.
Yeah.
They literally kicked him to the curb.
God.
And then with Katrina right. and with... And I wonder, had he had those benefits, if he may have been able to work in different jobs. I mean, he was just working at the grocer.
Yep.
And I guess it was really Addie
yeah.
involved with the booze and drugs and their friend Squirrel. But I don't know. You just wonder if, like... You wonder in a situation like this, if one... What is it like? What's it called? Like the butterfly effect, or yeah. the like? You just wonder yeah. if one change
exactly
would have made a difference for or these two.
Zach staying in high school and graduating and not moving in with his dad, would he have not ended up in New Orleans? Like, you know, there all of these things came together in this just complete tragedy and sad loss of two lives and very negatively affected. Other lives. Like yeah. I just think of Zach's kids and not that they were the only ones affected. There are plenty of other people, but that is what an unfortunate twist to that too, that it would have been bad enough had they not known any details when they were that young.
Right.
But man, wow.
Well, so if you're enjoying listening to Grimm,
Laura's not. Please rate and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts to make sure you don't miss any episodes. If you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, make our day by leaving us a written review. You can find our page on Facebook by searching Grimm: A True Crime Podcast. If you want to subscribe to our Patreon and join us on Discord, you can go to Patreon and search Grimm: A True Crime Podcast. Follow us on Instagram at Grimm Crime Podcast for information on future episodes and case photos. If you want to send us a case suggestion or just say hi, you can email us at grimcrimepodcast@gmail.com. Listen, learn, and stay alive until next time, Gremlins, because the future is grim.